Well, welcome to Dairy Livestream. I'm your host, Corey Geiger, managing editor of Hordes Dairyman. We are broadcasting live from the Cheese Cave, our studio in downtown Fort Atkinson at the historic W.D. Horde & Sons Company building, commissioned by former Wisconsin Governor W.D. Horde. We have four great panelists, and they look forward to answering your questions in the second half of the broadcast. You may ask a question by submitting it to the GoToWebinar question panel. I'd like to remind our audience to ask questions early so we have ensured time to ask them during our webcast as we delve through the topic options and opportunities for marketing my milk. This talk wraps up a six-part dairy live stream series on milk pricing and potential federal milk marketing order reform. It's my pleasure to make an exciting announcement regarding Dairy Live Stream. The May 5th episode, along with today's episode, and all future episodes for that matter, are now available as a podcast. That's correct. Dairy Livestream can be viewed both as a YouTube video or as an audio version as a podcast the very next day after our Wednesday broadcast. We added the podcast option so that busy dairy farmers can listen to Dairy Livestream via Bluetooth or on your phone in your trucks or tractors. You will easily find the YouTube or podcast version under webcasts. It's a drop-down button on our homepage at www.hordes.com. With four guests waiting in the wings, let's go straight to our first poll question as we discuss options and opportunities for marketing my milk. What percent of the U.S. milk supply is handled by the top 50 U.S. dairy co-ops? Select one of the answers, 61%, 71%, 81%, or 91%. So we'll give the audience a little time to go ahead and answer that question. And this is actually tracked by our top 50 co-op list that we do each year in our October issue. And the correct answer is 48%. Or excuse me, 81%. Yes, 81%. Jeff Lyon, our first guest, joined the Farm First Dairy Cooperative in 2018 as general manager. The co-op has over 3,000 members across seven states. The Farm First Dairy Cooperative is the nation's seventh largest dairy co-op based on that Hordes Dairyman Top 50 co-op list. Before joining Farm First, Jeff served as Deputy Ag Secretary at the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, where he also became Interim Secretary for a four-month period. Prior to that role, Jeff spent 22 years at the Wisconsin Farm Bureau working in the area of state and federal lobbying and member services. Before that, Jeff served as an agricultural aide to U.S. Representative Steve Gunnarsson, a Republican from Wisconsin, and was also the Assistant Director for the National Commission on Dairy Policy. Jeff, tell us more about Farm First, in particular its milk marketing division, so that guests can better gain an appreciation for all it takes in balancing member milk supplies when interacting with processors. Okay. Welcome, Jeff.
Thank you, Corey. I appreciate the opportunity to be on Dairy Live Stream. When I get the announcements, I've sat in as a participant to listen in and learn. And again, I appreciate the opportunity to be on. Just a little bit about Farm First Dairy Cooperative, then I'll get into our milk marketing that we do. Farm First came about as the merger in 2013 of two milk test verification cooperatives and another longstanding milk marketing cooperative that also did milk test verification. Those of you that don't know on the milk test verification, the cooperatives came about with the federal orders. So when you got into classified pricing and orderly marketing, those kinds of things, that when the orders were being put in place, required hammers to pay minimum prices. USDA had a deduction or charge for those services, and hammers could pay that directly to USDA, or they could handle by a cooperative. So cooperatives like ours sprung up, and like I said, we're a merger of three cooperatives, Wisconsin-based ones, and as you said, we have members in seven states. Part of the legal requirement as being a test verification cooperative is that my staff does test verification, gets for our members, sees what the components are for their milk, make sure that everything is in line so that they're paid properly for the components, everything in their milk. obviously, and also the volume. Another part of it, just had our staff meeting this morning and talking about my staff doing a lot of tank calibrations in cooperation with the plants that we work with, that, you know, make sure that the correct amount of milk, so both the farmer and the plant are being treated fairly with tank calibration. So we do a lot of those kinds of things as well. Another thing that came out of those was the representation. Obviously, well, it's not part of any of the other things, but when these farmers got together, and our members, a lot of our members are shipped to proprietary plants, but they didn't have representation on in federal order or federal issues, legislative issues, regulatory issues, and so we got very involved with that. One of the other parts of our cooperative that came with one of our predecessor cooperatives is we run a milk testing laboratory in Kaukauna, Wisconsin, Fox Valley Quality Control. So we're in the milk testing business. And then now I guess I'll move into our milk marketing. Like I said, our predecessor, two family dairies started in the early 1970s as a milk marketing cooperative. We do not process, we do not have a processing plant. We're marketing to other processors. We do have an intake reload facility in Keewaskin, Wisconsin, which is down in southeast Wisconsin, that we use for balancing milk. So most of our milk will go directly to our customers, to our buyers, but we do have some milk that goes there. So we use it basically for balancing. Obviously, we keep the, you know, milk at the proper temperature for, you know, doing reloads. And then when we have partial loads, we can, you know, get them back up to, you know, full loads, that kind of thing, to improve efficiencies. We have within our milk marketing division about 160 patrons in Northeast and East Central Wisconsin and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. We have about anywhere from 10 to 12 handlers that we have supply agreements with. We also sell spot loads. For some of those processors that we work with, we're the exclusive provider of milk for them. We, you know, we're the only ones that provide them milk. We have others that would get milk, you know, from other people, you know, that, you know, do supply milk. And then also we work with plants that have patrons, but they use us to supply additional milk that they need, you know, for whatever their needs. So, and then we sell milk. Our buyers are in all four classes of milk. So we're selling, obviously, in Wisconsin, we sell to cheese plants, but we supply milk to a fluid bottler, and then we supply milk to class two and class four as well. So we're involved in all of areas of there. Like everyone else, or primarily everyone else, and you know, work with a group of independent haulers. So we have various haulers that work with us, you know, and working in shipping milk. Just to get into a little bit into my director of milk marketing, Mick Holm, for Family Dairies, just a little bit his responsibilities. One, I think, really needs to know is that we provide a valuable service to our customers, our buyers, in the fact that you know, we're the person that they go to when they need milk. As I said, if they don't have patrons, those kinds of things, they're relying on milk. We have a relationship with them, a partnership with them. We supply them you know, the milk they need. If they're needing additional milk, they're not out chasing around it. They give my director of milk marketing a call, and we try to find that milk for them and you know, to take care of them. So we've built a real good partnership relationship with them, you know, that take milk. Obviously, we get milk when they need it, and then sometimes when milk is long, when there's a big supply of it, you know, they'll take some milk too. You say we kind of work together and do very well there. Obviously, we're in communication with the procurement people daily, weekly. Schedule gets done on Thursday to find out what their needs are, and depending upon time of year, you know, those things can really change. You can have you know, you get a phone call, you think they're going to get their normal amount. Well, then they say, oh, we're going to be maintenance, or the holidays coming up, or our buyers, you know, their buyers are saying, hey, demand is down, we don't need as much milk. Or like this week, hey, demand is up, we need more milk. So it's a constant balance of what we have to do. So you're working with the haulers. Most of the time they're going to the same places, but you really have a real balancing act of trying to move that milk around, because like I said, any week, normal week, it'll be okay, so-and-so needs more, somebody needs less. And we work with plants too. We work with plants that would just be a single Wisconsin plant, but then we also work with some larger plants that would have different locations and might be producing a different product at each of those, different cheeses or something like that. So they might have differences in demand. The other part of it, what we have, and I think that we provide a valuable service is that some of our buyers, occasionally they're looking for organic milk or grass-fed milk or A2 milk. And, they give us a call and Mick Hallmark, director, milk marketing, he finds that milk and gets it to them. We don't have any of our patrons that are producing grass-fed or organic. So we have to go out and find that. But that's one of the services that we provide and being able to get that milk for them. And then obviously we have, the real challenge that we have right now, and I think any time, has been the balancing of the milk supply. We get times when we're long, and trying to move milk, different locations, finding buyers. Sometimes when milk gets tight, then we're looking for milk and buying it, those kinds of things. And we need to balance that with, how many patrons do we have? Do we want to move on and get more patrons? Do we stay with what we have? Those kinds of things. But I'll just leave it there. That's just a little bit what we do. Like I said, no processing facility, but we're a very valuable part of the Wisconsin milk business for a lot of processing plants, not relying on patron milk, but buying that milk.
Going back to the beginning of our health pandemic, Jeff, that had been a heck of a roller coaster when March and April rolled around. When you talk about balancing milk, what was different about that?
As everybody can remember, we were coming, out of 19. We're kind of going, hey, things look like they're going to be, looking pretty good. And January and February, we thought, hey, things were turning around. Mark can probably have the numbers as to what they were. And then I remember, because I was out in D.C. for a trip out there in March 13th. And then by the 16th, we had our buyers just saying, with the pandemic and everything closing, we do not need as much milk. And obviously our customers, too, they're in retail, but they're also in wholesale, food service, those kinds of things. So it was crazy in that part of March. When we were, not sure, whether we were going to be able to find a home for milk, we got real close to thinking that we might have to dump milk. We were fortunate. Not everybody was as fortunate as us. We did find a buyer for our milk, obviously not at the prices that we'd want, but we figured it's better than putting it on the ground. So it, it was crazy, but, different times I've written different things. I think what really came through was our dairy industry and our transportation system really did well to make the adjustments pretty darn fast and be able to, change marketing and change what they were going to do and take care of all those things. But it was very frantic, I'll put it that way.
Thank you, Jeff. I'd like to remind our audience that you can go ahead and ask questions of our panelists today. You can do that in the GoToWebinar control panel. We're going to put up our next poll question before we, and that question is this: cheese production accounts for what percent of the milk fat supply in the United States? 32.5%, 42.5%, 52.5%, or 62.5%? And this is based on USDA data that's put together each year by the AMS division of USDA. So we'll go ahead and answer that poll question here. And we will cut that off here and show you the results were a little bit across the board here. The correct answer is 42.5%. That number has grown a great deal in the past 20 years. As in 2000, the answer would have been 37.7%. So our milk supply has grown, but cheese continues to grow faster. And we welcome Audie Wall to Dairy Livestream. Audie is Vice President of Manufacturing for the Marcoot Jersey Creamery that is operated by Audie and the Marcoot sisters, Amy and Beth. While the Marcoot family has been in the dairy business for seven generations, tracing back to when their family immigrated from Switzerland to America in 1842, the Marcoot's Creamery is relatively new enterprise for the family, and it's been in operation for 11 years now. Our guest, Audie Wall, has been with the creamery from its very early days, and she has even transitioned into fabricating equipment, some equipment necessary for processing at the plant. Audie, early on, the Marcoot family produced both beverage, milk, and cheese, and then you quickly turned your attention to cheese. Tell us more about that journey and what the future looks like for Marcoot Jersey Creamery. Welcome, Audie.
Hi, thank you for the opportunity, Corey. And there's been a lot of things that we've had to develop at the creamery just to basically survive and to support our milk production and also to have a diversity to sell to our local area market. And we typically sold very locally when we first opened our creamery in the Illinois region and then also in the St. Louis area. The St. Louis market has been a big part of our region that we've developed our brand and have sold a majority of our cheese to. But the last 4 to 5 years has definitely been a change for our company where we've been selling more regionally, and we've been actually selling to, you know, the whole state of Missouri, Indiana, Wisconsin, Ohio, Minnesota, even Kentucky. And we've tried to outreach a broader area as we've actually grown our the amount of cheese that we've been producing. So we started out just making cheeses. We make about 20 different styles of cheeses. We have fresh cheeses such as fresh mozzarella and cheese curds and quark. And then we also have farmstead cheeses that we categorize into cheddars, goudas, Havarti, that sort of a thing. And then we also have aged cheeses that we age out even longer, like Tome and Alpine style cheeses as well. And so we have a kind of a broad range of what the shelf life of the cheese is. So we can sell the fresh cheeses quickly the same day that we make them to help with our cash flow. And then we have the other cheeses that can age and can sit on the shelf for a while. So we can have that cash available later, either in the month or in many months or years down the road as well. So we kind of spread out how we cash flow our business with the types of cheeses and how much milk we put in each kind of cheese as well. And of course, you know, people love the fresh cheeses right away because they taste the best when they're very fresh. And we give that to our customers because typically we can get the product to them within a day to 2 days after we make the fresh cheeses. And so that's one of the very most popular items, especially in the St. Louis and Missouri region, because they can receive the product so quickly, they get the benefit of it being very fresh coming from our farm and from our creamery. So you can literally have, you know, milk in the cow the same day that we produce the milk, or sorry, produce the cheese, and then we send it out within 1 to 2 days after we make it. We made cheese curds today that we're actually shipping out today as well. So we just we're small and versatile that we can provide that fresh product to our consumers and to our distributors as well. Another product that we make is called Whey or Extreme Ice. And what it is it's a kind of a fruit sorbet. It's almost got an Italian ice feel to it. And we take our sweet cream whey from our cheese and we add crushed fruit to it as well. And then it's frozen. And it's a very high protein snack. We actually increase the whey protein content. So you get 20 grams of protein in a 5 ounce cup. We've been making that for a couple of years now, and we've developed it with professional athletes in mind. We actually started developing it when we worked with the St. Louis Cardinals, and they wanted a high protein snack for a recovery product for their baseball players. And it's been pretty successful. Last year, we were supposed to be hitting the sales hard with all the sports teams, and then COVID hit. And so we didn't quite get the jump that we wanted to on that product, but we're working on it this year and trying to get it out to as many sports teams as possible. But that's just another way that we're trying to make money off of the same milk that we're using for the cheese. So we're trying to add value to our product by taking that sweet cream whey that would either be fed to our cows or dumped down the drain right now because we don't have anybody to sell our excess whey to. But so we're making a nice snack, dessert, sorbet type style treat that is relatively healthy and no added sugars or anything like that, but it has a high protein content in it. And then we're also making a new cheese that's dehydrated, and we're selling it as a dog treat. And we've been developing that the past year and learning how to dehydrate cheese and making it shelf stable so we can ship it basically nationally across the US as well. So we've been trying to keep innovative and keep hitting some key markets that other companies are not hitting right now, but then also just trying to do things because we can be versatile because we are smaller and we can do special types of cheeses for people as well. So we also do specialty cheeses for breweries or other businesses that would like special cheeses made that they can put their own label on as well. We've done tipsy cheddars with Schlafly from the St. Louis area. And then we also have done some in other regions. We've done one with Kona Brewery in Hawaii, items like that as well. So we can partner with other businesses and get marketing from kind of both sides with the alcohol or beer side, but also within the dairy aisle or in the deli aisle as well. So Audie, we kind of have a vast array of things we do.
Audie, one of the things you used early at words that you said a number of times was cash flow. And obviously when you're starting up a business, there's a boundless ideas, but then you have to decide which ones are winners you're going to pursue. But now you're a decade into it, and you shared with me that recently you hired a salesperson and engaged a marketing firm, and you're even considering buying milk from neighboring farms. Talk about that growth. And remember, you were walking a decade ago, and now you're starting to get a good jog going, if I may put those words to the table.
Yes, yeah, so it takes time with any new business, but especially for a business in the dairy industry. It's a very competitive industry. And because we are smaller, we have higher overhead and operating costs compared to a large plant, manufacturing plant, or even a dairy farm for that matter. So our overhead costs for our just our farm and our manufacturing are a little bit higher than what you would get at a large manufacturing plant or dairy. So we have to come up with creative ways to be able to come up with those funds and to keep our products at a reasonable price. So we can hit a majority of the market that can actually purchase them, but also keep our facility going. Whenever you're starting up a small facility like ours, we typically milk anywhere from about 70 cows to 120 cows throughout the year right now, just depending on the time of year and when we have calves come in. We just started calving again right now, and so we're starting to get another influx of milk, which is good for the summer because cheese sales tend to go up right now. So it's a lot of time because we have like three or four businesses in one business because we're operating the farm, we're operating the production, the manufacturing, but then also we're doing the sales and marketing as well. And it does take special skill sets to be able to do all of that. And because I am here and because Amy and Beth are operating as well, we have three of us that have kind of different backgrounds that can kind of fill in those holes and gaps to be able to get the job done. So, and we have to hire outside help as well. Like you said, the marketing company, and we have, you know, other resources that we hire with social media as well. We have people that work on Twitter and Instagram and our website pages and that sort of thing. So.
Well, thank you, Audie. We're going to go straight to our next poll question before we invite Jen on the webcast. Fluid milk accounts for 11.3% of all milk fat, but what does fluid milk account for on a skim solids basis? So we're talking about the fat being skimmed off. Now, I'm going to give you a hint. That number is going to be higher than 11.3. Question, is it? So we're getting quite a few votes coming rolling in here. Hopefully I didn't tip the scales too much, but we'll gonna give you another 10 seconds to answer that question. And of course, when milk fat is skimmed off, it's repurposed for other dairy products. It could be used for butter, could be, or cream, or those kind of things. So let's go ahead and show the results of that poll question. The correct answer is 21.7%. So 63% of you got that correct. We asked that question because our next guest, Jen Glover, and her family specialize in fluid milk sales, with their farm being located just 60 miles from the Atlanta, Georgia Metroplex. Jennifer and her husband, Scott, own and operate Mountain Fresh Creamery, with milk supplied by the family's Glowcrest Dairy. In addition to Jennifer and Scott, the family business has over 15 employees to run both operations. The creamery specializes in beverage milk, ice cream, and butter. Although Jennifer didn't grow up on a dairy farm, she quickly got up to speed after marrying her husband, Scott, a fourth-generation dairyman. Today, Jennifer serves on the board of directors for the American Dairy Association of Georgia and has served on the Governor's Advisory Council for Childhood Obesity. Like Audie, the Glovers have about a decade of experience with their creamery operations that started in July 2011. Jennifer, what can you tell us about that 10-year journey as other dairy farmers may contemplate engaging in a similar business as yours? Welcome to Dairy Livestream, Jen.
Hey, Corey. Thank you for having me today online for the live stream, and thanks for having someone from the southern states that dairy farms here in the South to be vocalizing what we do down here as well. I want to say quickly that if we could have the quick poll questions as a Jeopardy category one night, my family would finally win. So that would be great. But my husband and I started Mountain Fresh Creamery almost now 11 years ago. We did that because we wanted to stay in the dairy business, and we wanted to stay in the dairy business in the South near where we live. So we knew we really had two choices. Either move somewhere that wasn't so close to Atlanta so that we could purchase more land and milk more cows, or build a creamery. And so we decided to go that route, and it's been successful in the past 11 years. When we first started, we really found out that we needed to visit some folks that were already doing this successfully. So we did that. We visited a lot of people that were very honest and transparent with us about the hurdles that you have to go through. Because really, truly, it's just like having two dairies. You have your dairy farm where you're milking. We also offer tours there. So we have people on our farm several times during the week. So we have to have everything in tip-top shape there. And then we have the creamery aspect, which runs as two separate businesses. So we have small business with the dairy and small business with the creamery, where we really struggle with things like having the correct help and the people in the correct positions. But right now we're making it work. But every day is a new day, and it seems like every day is a new problem. But at the creamery, we do non-homogenization and low temp pasteurization. We do whole milk, chocolate milk, low fat milk, buttermilk. But really, truly, what pays the bills is our ice cream. We do about 10 to 15 flavors a week. And at our retail store, we have a silo where we dip ice cream and make milkshakes with our milk and ice cream. And then we have a wholesale business side of the creamery where we wholesale our products to about 100 retail places in the Atlanta area and north. So it's a different business from the dairy. But right now it's helping us pay the bills and have the ultimate dream of continuing to stay in the dairy business.
Thank you, Jen. One of the things that I know you shared with, you and Scott shared with me in the past, is that your farm's breeding philosophy has changed a bit, and now you're using only A2 bulls that carry for milk protein. What have your customers been sharing with you in it regarding A2 milk?
So here where we are in Georgia, we have a small percentage of the population that is beginning to be interested in that. We have a lot of folks that come in. Our cows are on grass, but we also have a freestall barn. So we feel like we have a good ratio of that. You know, the summers are really hot here in Georgia. So we have folks that, you know, want to see cows on the pasture all the time. And we do that whenever the weather is optimal. But we also have our freestall barn that has water beds and fans and misters that we have to have because of the heat. So we have to have a good mix of that, because our customers that come on our farm tours, or when they come to the creamery, that's one of the first questions that they want to know. So we talk a lot about why we're moving to A2. We talk a lot about our cows are outside on pastures, but not 100%, and why it's that way. We talk a lot about why we are not non-GMO because of the availability of feed for that in our area. We talk about the health benefits that are associated with non-homogenization and low-temp pasteurization. But mainly we focus with them on how we treat our cows and the quality of life that they have and how fresh and local that our product is.
Thank you, Jen. I really appreciate that additional perspective. So we're going to go to our final poll question here, and we're going to talk a little butter here. Butter production accounts for what percent of milk fat in the U.S. milk supply? You can select one of the following: 8.6, 18.6, 28.6, or 38.6. So go ahead and answer that question before we invite our regular contributor, Dr. Mark Stevenson, back to Dairy Livestream. So the poll question is rolling pretty good here. We'll go ahead and put that answer on the board. And our audience got the correct answer. It's 18.6. And I think we all know that butter has been on a rebound, and that proportion was only 16.3% in 2000. And I think one of the things we got to remember about the milk supply, so butter and cheese have been growing. The milk supply in the last 20 years in the U.S. has grown 33%. That's 55.5 billion pounds of milk. So these categories are growing even with a whole lot more milk out there. Mark, specific to you, Jeff, Audie, and Jen have unique businesses. We got a co-op, we got a cheese enterprise, we got a fluid milk enterprise. However, their stories have similar narratives as we discuss options and opportunities for marketing my milk. Mark, what's your take?
Well, I think we've got some really interesting contrasts here in along a marketing chain or perspective, you know, from the farm that has a bargaining co-op like Jeff represents, all the way up to the value added and getting very close to the consumer. Probably one segment that's really missing would be a processing co-op as well, you know, as another portion along that marketing chain. I'll tell both Audie and Jen, I do get questions from producers all the time about value added. And, you know, my first instinct is to just throw buckets of cold water all over them. And if there's still steam coming off afterward, then let's talk, because it is not an easy task to do value added. You know, one of the first things you have to ask is, presumably you're a good dairy producer. You're good at making milk and do a good job of that. I think that that's an imperative for starting to have this kind of discussion. But then, you know, the next thing you really want to ask is, what is the skill set that makes you a good dairyman that would also make you a good creamery operator? And many of those skills are not transferable. You know, for one thing, you'll find that when you get down to marketing your product, having to get out there, maybe going to the farmer's market as a starter part of it, or going to retail stores to set up there occasionally and, you know, talk about the farm experience, means that you've got to be quite an extrovert and talk about that farm story. That's not always the case for many of our producers and growers, and it's a big part of what it takes to be successful. I actually remembered yesterday when we were talking a little bit about a piece that I had read by an ag economist who is maybe almost two generations before me. And in fact, he wrote kind of the definitive book on agricultural marketing at about the time I was born. And, you know, you can kind of tell by my white hair that that was some time ago. He had another piece that he had written a little bit after that. There was just a short one pager. And so I wanted to read just a couple of sentences or paragraphs out of that that I thought were very germane to this. It says, contrary to popular opinion among farmers, markets are not a right. No one individual, no one industry owns a franchise on the market. You have to work and scheme and sweat to produce the raw products of agriculture, but that doesn't give you the right to a market. To get that right, you also have to work and scheme and sweat to create markets, to take markets away from someone else, and to keep someone else from taking your market. Marketing and selling are not synonymous. To sell means to get rid of, to transfer ownership, and anybody can do that. On the other hand, to market means to create value, to perform service for which someone is willing to pay, to perform service on which a profit can be made. And finally, he wraps up and says, we also need to recognize that much of the value of any product lies not in the product itself, but rather in the invisible bundle of services wrapped around it. For those who perform such services are the creators of an economic good every bit as much as those who produce the physical product. And I think that's really germane in our talk here. I mean, a lot of what Jeff does is provide a great deal of service to the milk by recognizing that time and place are services. So we have to get milk to the plants that want them and need them at the time they do need them. And that has the bundle of characteristics, whether he's scrounging around for A2 milk or organic for somebody, that's a service that he's adding to those products, or if we've got surplus, to find a home for it. Same kind of thing for both Audie and Jen. You know, the products that they're making, they're having to deal with balancing their own milk supplies. I think that Audie told us yesterday that they are processing all of their milk, but in order to do that, they have to think about what cheeses do I make during what times of the year, and as some of their cows are calving now, I'm imagining that some of their longer hold cheeses are going to be made to kind of take that surge of milk forward in time. But they also have to think about culling cows when they're having more milk than they want or need. Jen, on the other hand, is doing some marketing with their balancing needs through a cooperative down there. So marketing is not an easy thing, but it's absolutely essential. And when producers look at this difference between what am I receiving for my milk price and what do I see cheese is costing me in the store or a gallon of milk or something else, and who's getting rich off of that, we have to remember that there's a whole bundle of services that's taking place from the farm all the way to that consumer. And people that are adding that value have to be paid for it as well. So that's kind of what I thought I'd toss in here for the discussion and maybe go to some questions.
Well, Mark, that gentleman who wrote that paper, I believe, has a building named after him at Cornell. Am I not mistaken?
Well, not quite. I thought that it was that person, too. But this is Max Brunk. He was a well-known marketer. He did. He was a faculty member there at Cornell for a long, long time, but predated me by quite a few years.
It's amazing that those comments are almost timeless, really, quite frankly. I want to remind our audience here that you can go ahead and ask questions of any of our guests by typing them into the GoToWebinar control panel, and we will get those asked to our guests here. We're going to start out with a question that came in, and it's going to Jeff here. And the question reads like this: as co-op members continue to grow, and we're talking dairy farmers, as co-op members continue to grow in size and establish a greater degree of independence, how can co-ops remain an attractive option? In other words, how can dairy co-ops remain relevant as milk marketers? And I, you know, the demographics of our country have changed a great deal on dairy farms. We're almost pushing close to a 300 cow herd size. So the world has changed a lot since the 26 years ago that I joined the Horse Dairyman staff. What's your take, Jeff?
Well, part of it is I think, your thoughts and your beliefs in cooperative business, regardless of the, the changes in the sizes of operation. And our members, our patrons at Family Dairies, they're all different size operations. Our members that we do test verification services are all, different size operations. And while, you might have some, some people might consider large farms, other small farms. I never know what that definition is anymore because it's something different for everybody. But it's the cooperative philosophy of doing business too. And I come from a strong background of cooperative business. So it's in belief in it. So it's part of, farmers working together, like I said, in supplying, in our case, supplying different people, different processors, milk. If it's a processing plant, as Mark said, a cooperative that has a processing plant, a little bit different than what we do, but it's a belief in the cooperative business model as being a successful model, and it's proven to be a very successful model, regardless of the size of operations, those kinds of things. Because you might think you're a big operation, but over time, suddenly you become a pretty small operation too. So I think it's philosophy of that.
And Mark, I have a follow-up question for that that kind of is a derivative of what Jeff just answered. Herd sizes in farms may be growing, but then there's this retail sector, and the big fish out there are pretty darn big, the Walmarts and the Amazons of the world. So as a producer thinks that their size has grown and their presence in the marketplace, there's a whole other world out there that I would like you to comment on a little bit, Mark.
Well, consolidation has certainly had its impact on the dairy markets. You may remember, how far back do I have to go now? 20 years? Was it when we began to see Suiza and Dean Foods at that time begin to gobble up plants and then ultimately merge into a single organization of Dean's? And now that's part of DFA. But they were motivated to do that very much because they saw the consolidation occurring in the retail segment. And some of the retailers, that represented stores from coast to coast wanted to have a single supplier or relatively few suppliers across their entire geography. So they felt the need to become bigger bottlers and processors. And of course, then you had co-ops looking at that going, if we're going to be supplying milk to these processors, we need to have milk supplies across the country as well. And so we saw a lot of consolidation there. And finally, that just coincided with the time period when farms were feeling as though if I'm good enough to be able to manage people more than cows, then perhaps I should be exploring some scale economies as well. And, much of that began to mushroom. So it trickles all the way through the system.
The next question here, we're going to send to Audie and to Jen. They touched on it a little bit here, but one of the things we talked about balancing, we've talked about scaling, but we'll start with Audie and then we'll go to Jen. How far in advance do you receive orders and schedule to make those products? And how does this affect how you balance your milk supply? Some of this is obviously projections too, because you do have a decade of experience as well. Audie, why don't you tackle that one first?
Great. Well, typically for our cheese orders, we have it at least a week ahead of time, if not 2 weeks. But people aren't perfect. And so a lot of times we'll get last minute orders and that somebody forgot to place an order or, the normal chef or something wasn't working at the restaurant or the distributor forgot to place it. But so we have a kind of an idea of like what our weekly order is going to be. And we try to project out each week kind of planned on how we're going to make our cheeses and then package our fresh cheeses and cut our aged cheeses to fill those orders. And so most of the time we can typically have about a week to 2 week lead. But then we have certain situations where, we'll get a last minute order. And since we are smaller, we can be a little bit more flexible and still try to get those orders filled on a last minute basis because we don't have like a a real high minimum or anything like that to try to get the orders filled. So,
Jen?
Yeah, so a similar answer. And when Jeff was talking earlier, it really rang true with how our creamery works. It's all about balance. So we have to look at how much whole milk we're going to run, how much low-fat milk we're going to run. We can only run as much ice cream as low-fat milk we run because we pull the cream off of our low-fat milk to make our ice cream mix. So balance is really key to us. Most of our larger chain grocery stores and other retail outlets give us about a week lead time, and pretty much it stays the same from week to week. Our team at the creamery does a really good job at looking at inventory and how much we're selling out of our retail store and what our wholesale numbers look like from the week before. But we have to look at careful things like summertime, our sales go down some because school's out and people are on vacation, so we're not selling as much whole milk gallons. So it's really a lot about supply and demand. But as a small business, we really have to keep a careful eye on that because any milk that we pick up or any milk that we don't sell, we donate to a local food bank and to some local agencies in our area. We try not to mark the price of milk down any lower than it already is. So it's really a careful thing that we have to keep a close eye on as a small business. But generally, I would say about a week in advance for our whole milk. Our ice cream has a longer shelf life on it, but really, truly, it's hard to even keep that in supply and to keep up with that right now.
Jeff, one of the things that your team, and you have a significant team that works with you at Farm First, you have to juggle a lot of things. What overall, since you've been there, what do you find is one of the couple more difficult things in marketing a product, or not product necessarily, moving milk to different processors? And what's the most rewarding part of that?
I think we're kind of falling all over each other here with the answers, as Jen said too. And it's the hardest and the challenge on the milk marketing side of things is obviously, as I mentioned in my early comments, is balancing things because, you know, Audie and Jen talked about the, you know, the week to 2 weeks. Well, we get those same kinds of things with us too, you know, where, you know, it, like the weather will change considerably because if we're, you know, supplying and that's somebody who's, you know, ice cream, you know, all kinds of things, weather gets nice in Wisconsin, you know, then, you know, more consumption there. So they're asking for more milk. And then you hit a different time of year, you know, holidays up, you know, with the cheese, all those different kinds of things. We work with another company, does different kinds of cheeses, you know, and they'll say, you know, because they'll have new buyers coming in or, you know, they'll tell us, hey, we got a new buyer coming in. We think it's going to work. And then all of a sudden, you know, in 2 weeks, we're going, hey, that fell through. So then you're sitting here trying to figure out what, you know, where you're going to move the milk. And like I said, when you're dealing with all four classes of milk, you know, different times you can have you know, different kind of demands. So you really have to be flexible and be able to move that milk around in our case. As far as most rewarding, it's, you know, just kind of a standard line for our patrons is feeling good about yourself that every day you can make sure that the bulk tank is emptied for every dairy farmer every day, because that's what it's all about. They're milking the cows, they're doing those kinds of things, and it's our job to sell it and get the best price that we can for them. And you know, it's, like I said, might be a little hokey, but that is a good feeling every day. But it's a responsibility that we have as well too. So those kinds of things. And then I guess it's just the partnership and the relationship that we have with our people that we supply milk to, that we try to work together, that because they're interested in you know, what's good for the farmer too, because obviously they know that they need to have farms out there to be able to supply the milk too. And I think they're real good about that.
Mark, you've been involved in advising a lot of different dairy groups, and I'm talking processors, co-ops, farmers, and all that. And we're co-chair of the Dairy 2.0 Task Force in Wisconsin. Now, that looked specifically at Wisconsin, but a lot of the learning moments parlay to any dairy farm across the country. And one of those learning moments, I know in Wisconsin, they have a grant program where a farm could study about opening a creamery on their farm. Talk about that importance of the early investigation on that, and how, and maybe, you know, how you've advised some farmers here, and maybe we'll follow up with Audie and Jen and talk a little bit about how they did their research.
Well, in many cases, you know, I want to ask why they want to do it. And if somebody just tells me that, you know, I'm having a hard time making ends meet milking cows. So I think if I do this, you know, I'll capture some of those upstream profits. That's probably not, in my experience, a very good reason for doing this. You need to be successful at milking cows first, and then give me a better reason, you know, for doing something else. I think one of the excellent reasons may be I've got a son or a daughter or, you know, somebody else who's coming back to the farm. We need to have the income for another family. We're landlocked. We can't really expand our cows. So let's think about how we can generate more income from them, that base. That's very legitimate. Let's talk about this. And then we need to think about the business plan. What products? I mean, what is the passion for you personally? And go about it step by step. I do think that teaching somebody how to make curds and even good quality cheeses, even repeatedly, is one of the easier steps, you know, along the way. But knowing just how much stainless steel do I actually need is difficult. It's easy to get swept away with that and get a lot of overhead costs, you know, for stainless steel. It's only being used a few hours a day or maybe even a week. That's a problem. And, you know, just thinking about what your marketing strategy is. Are you going to try to sell this through distributors? Are you going to do it at the local farmers market? Are you going to try to, you know, have a farmstead creamery sales? Just exactly what is that? So it depends a lot on where you are. Are you close enough to population centers to do one versus the other? Or is it some combination of them? But the plans have to be well thought through, carefully implemented, and there are resources. Don't try to do it on your own.
One of the things when I was a senior at UW-Madison, one of my professors, Dr. George Shook, talked me into at the time, taking a food science class with Professor Bob Bradley, and myself and another friend. We went in that class, and we were with all these food science majors who wanted to pursue a dairy processing career. And he said at the first class, I was kind of nervous about being there because I'm like, what am I doing here? And he introduced us as two cow kids and told the rest of the food science kids, if those two fail, everybody gets an F in here because this is the interaction we need from both segments. And the last thing, our capstone experience, was developing a processing plant and balancing all the product flows. And we did that as teams, and it was a great learning moment. And I would say about anyone who wants to go in this endeavor, it should almost be repeated. Audie, a specific question to you. So you're a non-family member that joined Amy and Beth, the Marcoot family in Marcoot Jersey Creamery. Tell us a little bit about putting that business model together back in those early days, how that went.
Yeah, so we actually ended up a few years ago splitting the farm off from the creamery. And I think, Jen, you also said that you guys have separate businesses for your farm and your creamery. And I would highly suggest that just in general anyway, just for insurance reasons. And, you know, there's so much stuff that can go on with product. And if you ever have a recall or if there's anything else that's going on with your, you know, actual manufacturing business versus the farm, there's just so many things operationally that can go on between both of those businesses. But also number two, it's really hard to insure both of them under the same policy as well that we have found. So there's very specific insurance policies for farms, and there's very specific insurance things you can get from manufacturing as well. So we kind of decided that after, I don't know, being 7 years in the business together, I became part owner of the creamery, and we kind of split those off at that time, and we kind of restructured things as a business during that time. And it just gives you opportunity to, like, if you if you do need capital and you need to get it, have growth or an investor, or if you want to bring on partners, that gives you the capacity to be able to do that, because if you don't want somebody else to own your farm and have access to your land or property, then it's a good way to keep that entity separate and have those people become part of your company or business. So if you need that type of, you know, financial structure, it gives you the opportunity to be able to do that as well.
Jen, you and your husband shared a three-word answer with me, and it was location, location, location. And it involves your establishment of a creamery and a retail outlet. So you did that at a different location than your farm. Talk about that.
Our location of our creamery is on a well-traveled road that actually is at the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. And so it's on a very traveled road for people that are commuting back and forth to a city for work, but also people that are commuting on a vacation journey. And so we chose that location. We have about 10 acres on the side of this pretty major highway. We keep some of our heifers there, so when people come to shop, and to get ice cream, they actually feel like that they're on the farm. Our physical building looks like a barn with a silo on the side, so it adds to that motif. But our barn and our dairy farm is about 2 miles away, and it's set up nicely so that when we do our farm tours, people can come to the farm, they can see the process from the start to the finish. And then we travel from the farm. We have it set up with viewing windows so that they can see during milking time. We do a tour there, and then we travel to the creamery so that they can see the milk being bottled, and they can also sample and then get ice cream. And we sell other products other than just milk and ice cream as well. But it's set up, like Audie said, it's set up that really works well for us running it as two different businesses. When Mark was talking about people deciding to start the first step in this journey, I always say, you know, have somebody look around your farm, because these folks that are going to be your consumers and your customers are going to want to come to your farm, and they're going to want to see your cows, and they're going to want to see how you care for them and how they're housed. So have an outsider come to your farm and look around. And if there's anything there that you wouldn't want to see on Fox News, you want to fix that before you decide that you want to start a creamery, especially if you're going to have them have the visibility of being at both locations. And same thing at the creamery. You got to have somebody there that loves people. So if you're a dairy farmer, and most dairy farmers that I know don't necessarily love people, you're going to need to make sure that you have somebody in your circle that loves somebody more than cows, because they're going to want to ask you a lot of questions, and they're going to want to be in your space. And so if that person is not you, find you somebody that can be that person.
Absolutely.
Very, very well said. You know, a lot of us that agriculture on farms are genuinely introverts. And you do need that extrovert that just keeps getting energy from people all day long and make maybe the most simplistic questions. That's going to wrap up this dairy live stream, options and opportunities for marketing my milk. Our next dairy live stream will be Wednesday, June 2nd, 2011 at 11 o'clock Central Daylight Time. And we're going to focus on a brewing situation. Could AI, as an artificial insemination, become illegal? Could cows become pets? Those are some pretty provocative titles for even Hordes Dairymen to put out there. But this conversation will be based on a ballot initiative that's emanating out from Colorado and Oregon. And we're going to tell you in that episode why everyone in all 50 states should be concerned, and how we can help maybe quell the situation before it becomes part of the state law in those two states. That show again will air June 2nd, 2021. And again, this episode and that episode will all be archived at www.hordes.com. It will be archived as a YouTube and a podcast the very next day. So Thursday, you can come see that. We look forward to seeing you then. On behalf of Jeff Lyon, Audie Wall, Jennifer Glover, and Mark Stevenson, I'm Corey Geiger, your host. Thank you for joining us today, and we wish you all a good day. Have a good day, everyone.